technology is based on the premise that there can be an optimization of things through algorithmic understanding. So ones and zeros data can be manipulated and thus produce an optimal outcome, which is a lovely idea for certain kinds of things. It's not necessarily, in my opinion, the best idea for the psyche or for happiness or for developing a life that's worth meaning. So I think a psychological mindset is slightly different in that most of us, unless we've trained as, you know, CBT clinicians, and even then, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it's not just data points, you know, input, output, handbook-based treatment. There's the relationship, and that's difficult to categorize. So I think psychologically speaking, people are really concerned, or our colleagues are really concerned with being with the person, making meanings, suffering sometimes through difficult things. So there isn't just an automatic assumption, as there is in the tech mindset, that we're trying to optimize for whatever it is that's good. It becomes very philosophical in the end. You know, what is optimized? What is good? Why should we do it? You know, there's all these kinds of questions that one might ask the technology mindset person. You know, why would we want to hack our nutrition or our mental health in order to become stronger, better? What? It's a little problematic, I think, as an end goal.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Nicole Zapien. Dr. Zapien comes to us from the world of technology, from initially being a math teacher in the inner city. She then trained and became a technology consultant in early Silicon Valley. And she describes this journey from one of those to the other, and then making a switch to the world of mental health services concerning ethical concerns that she describes in our conversation. But as a result of having been brought up in this world of technology and also bringing herself up in this world of analysis, she really speaks two languages. And we know that people who speak two languages, especially early on, have a very facile mind and a way to think in both spaces. And clearly, Nicole does that. She can talk the talk in tech and in analysis, but even more so as you listen to her, you will see that she does more than talk the talk. She really is an analyst and thinks as one. She's been very active in the analytic community. She is a post-seminar candidate at the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California, PINC, where she serves on the Ethics Committee and the Visiting Scholar Committee. She's also on the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Public Information. As I mentioned before this, she had been in the world of mental health. She was a professor and dean of the School of Professional Psychology and Health at California Institute of Integral Studies. And she currently has a grant from the IPA to study telehealth. A better suited person for that, I can't imagine. And she shares with us what she has learned from working in the tech community and the challenges and advantages that it brings in engaging these individuals clinically. And she gives us some clinical examples, making clear that the learning needs to go both ways, that yes, they need to learn things that we have to show them, teach them, and help them experience. And we also have things that we can learn from them, and we go into that. She, very importantly, has a podcast on the subjects that we're speaking of. The podcast is titled Technology in the Mind. I recommend it. She has a lovely way as an interviewer, and she even manages to bring that to being an interviewee, and that's not always easy. So I hope you find this as illuminating as I did. Here is my conversation with Dr. Nicole Zappian. Nicole, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole, we've been learning about analysts who have come to our field with prior professional experience. It's been a variety of things, from musicians to neurologists to immunologists to teachers. A number of prior professions have led them to now be interested in psychoanalysis. And while everybody has their journey to this work, people with prior professions have a little extra to the journey. That is, some people with prior professional experience bring their prior experience to their work as analysts, and they continue doing it either separately or they find a way to integrate it into their work as an analyst. And others, not at all. They entirely devote themselves to being what might be called a traditional analyst. Another difference I've noted is that many people discover their interest in analysis through their experience of being an analyst. Others, not at all. Others find themselves into the mental health world somehow. They're not patients, but they learn about this thing called psychoanalysis, and they're fascinated by it. And on that basis, they jump in to pursue training. We will get to all that as it applies to you, and also as it applies, as I've already mentioned, but I do want to mention again that you have brought your tech background, which we're going to learn about, to current day in your work as a podcaster. And you have a podcast. I recommend it to our listeners, Technology in the Mind. You could find it on the various podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Google, etc. And it is clearly worth a listen. But tell us, Nicole, who are you? How did you get into tech? What was that like for you? And from there, how did you get into psychoanalysis?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a bit of a circuitous path, Harvey. So I'll kind of wind the listeners through it all. I can't say that I was really directed in any particular way. I sort of let the waves of history take me. I graduated in the early 90s, and I'd studied math and psychology. And at that time, there was a teacher shortage in the United States. And what that meant was, and there is still a teacher shortage, actually. What that meant was there were a lot of really interesting jobs and really vibrant programs for new teachers, new career teachers to take up. So I landed myself a job in middle school teaching, teaching in the inner city. It was kind of a chaotic time. There was lots to do. Classrooms were filled with, 38 kids, and they were all different kind of skill levels and so on. And I found myself really kind of taking to, well, what is this? How can I help all of these children, some of whom had special needs, some of whom were gifted, some of whom were the average, typical student, to learn math? And at that time, in parallel, technology was sort of, this was in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area of the United States and California, where technology has really been at the fore. And at that time, there was a lot of people coming out of Stanford who were developing computer adaptive testing models for teaching. So what that meant is the idea was that we could test every child, figure out what their skill deficits were, and then teach to those skill deficits, and they would all be masterful at the end. So it was sort of like an independent learning plan for every single student. So I thought that was really intriguing, you know, having studied math and so on. So we, of course, administered these various programs and found that in the end, the students who were going to learn anyway, whether or not I taught well or didn't, or whether or not I taught to these particular skills deficits or not, seemed to do well anyway. Hmm. And the students who I thought were really struggling, maybe they had difficulties at home, or they had previous traumas, or they had, you know, special needs, may or may not do well with this kind of skill deficit intervention. And it seemed to have more to do with the relationship. And this is going to come as no surprise to psychoanalysts. It had more to do with my relationship with the students and what I could build, and with the emotional quality of the learning. So that was the first aha moment, like, huh, maybe it has nothing to do with the actual content that I'm teaching. It has more to do with the relationship and with the emotional side of things. So that was the first moment that I realized, wow, I don't have the actual skills and background to achieve my goal to teach all students. I need something more, something along the lines of psychological understandings or emotional understandings or understandings of group dynamics or something, to be able to help these students. So I'll just sort of set that thinking aside for a second and come back to it. Because in parallel, because schools were in such a disarray at that time, governments would give us, a really prominent reform idea at the time in the United States was, okay, school site governance and school site reform. So here's your school, you guys figure it out, was essentially what they would say. And we'll give you some autonomy to figure it out, because we'd realize that if you give teachers and administrators autonomy, they tend to produce really innovative and exciting programs that meet the needs of students, more so than if it comes from a top-down sort of state-level kind of process. And what that meant was that we would have to justify the programs that we were developing. So some of the creative things we did was, you know, push in and pull out kinds of services for students to help bolster their social-emotional learning. We did all kinds of things with bilingual education. We did things with really tearing down these ideas of gifted education and special education and so on. And some of those programs were useful. Being in the math department, they asked me to please write the program evaluation reports, because other people didn't have the statistics background or the skills to write these reports to justify our programs to the state. So I started my very beginning foray into program evaluation, research, both qualitative and quantitative research at the school site level. And then after a few years of working as a teacher, which probably for our international listeners might come as a surprise, teachers are not well paid in the United States, and they're also not well paid to this day, to the point where it's almost impossible to make a living wage. So there was kind of this thinking of mine, okay, maybe I could potentially make a living wage if I left teaching and used this research and program evaluation set of skills to work in the private sector. So that was the next aha moment. So after 5 years of teaching, I went and applied for a job as a marketing research consultant for a local firm in the Bay Area. And at that very same moment, there was, most people are probably familiar with SurveyMonkey, I imagine. It's got quite international cachet at the time. It was a pretty new tool, as was all of the various web platforms to collect data. And they were not really well accepted, I think. People were curious as to whether or not, can you actually get good data from web-based surveying? Can you trust what you're seeing in web-based kinds of platforms? So, you know, at that time I thought, well, why not? This is interesting. Let me explore what this is going to be like. So I started out as a consultant, using mostly web-based platforms to gather data for companies like Amazon and Google and Hewlett-Packard and Cisco and, you know, these kinds of big tech brands. At least in the States, they're big tech brands. And, you know, everything, Nokia and Samsung and Apple, and these were all of our clients. And at that time, many of these clients were very small. Google had only 3 employees, I think, when they first came to us to gather data. Yeah. Amazon had very few. They were wondering about questions like, would anyone ever put their credit card into a shopping platform and feel safe enough? So payments online hadn't yet been fully addressed. People didn't know how to keep it safe. People didn't know what the public would think. So security and privacy also wasn't full, you know, all the 2-step authentications that we do now that, that are typical and normal hadn't yet been fully, fully thought about and fully made usable to the public. And we didn't know if people would have consumer confidence. Google was asking questions like, how are we going to monetize this search engine? So they didn't have a stream of income. They just had a cool search engine and that was it. And thus began kind of the beginnings of advertising driven tools. So now it's pretty ubiquitous that most of the tools we have are actually backed. The money comes in through advertising. So, you know, these kinds of, some of the early research was also various companies trying to figure out how would cell phones be. So cell phones didn't exist at that time. Of course, the military had cell phones or things like that. There were lots of companies vying for the idea of which brand will people trust more for a tool that is portable, that can access lots and lots of other things and could be a massive device for marketing. And this tool, we weren't sure if it was going to be, you know, connected to your TV and in your living room, and it would run everything in your home, thus the smart home concept. We weren't sure if people wanted to have it portable on their bodies walking around. We weren't sure what it would look like or how it would be used. So there were lots of interesting questions that developed alongside with all of the technology that was developing at the time. And what I found myself doing, my role was a, you know, as account executive. So I would talk to these various companies, I would help them shape their research questions, then I would go about managing a team to collect the data, analyze it, and produce results for them. And those kinds of tests would be done online. So we might change the tagline or the color or various specifications of products and services and see how a group of 1,000 demographically representative folks of the US would respond. And we could determine in pretty quick, you know, you send out this invitation and within a few minutes you get back, you know, people enter the survey and you get back some results and you can pretty quickly tell that tagline A is more likely to get them to buy than tagline B, or portable cell phone like products are more preferred over, you know, some kind of TV based device. And it struck me kind of around that time that, wow, I'm part of a massive machine that's helping these companies sell more stuff that people may or may not need. And people seem to not be able to think for themselves. They seem to be very quickly influenced by colors or by shiny things on the website or by particular statements. We could influence them in one direction or the next. And that frightened me a great deal. So that was another aha moment. The cool thing about that particular company was that they had an education credit, so I could study and they would pay for it. So I enrolled right around then in an MFT program on the weekends and finished that degree while I was working as a consultant to these tech firms and while I was ambivalently concerned about what I was doing. And then segued
MFT
into,
is Masters of Family Therapy, yeah?
That's right. And then into counseling. Got my license. I eventually got a PhD in psychology and then found myself linking my first career in education with psychology by teaching at a local university. So I would teach in the master's in family counseling, you know, programs, various intro courses. After several years of doing that, I was appointed dean overseeing many different clinical degree programs from somatic psychology, all of which would end in a clinically licensable degree, experiential art therapy, PsyD program, and so on. And these programs and their clinics. So there were several clinics around San Francisco that I also oversaw. And in this work, this was the next aha moment, there were several faculty, you know, again, I'm overseeing all of these faculty, and some of these faculty were analysts. And what I noticed about the analysts was that they thought differently than the differently trained clinicians who were also on faculty. And I really admired the level of care and nuance that they brought to their thinking. And I also trusted them more somehow. I trusted their thinking. And I wanted to be surrounded by other clinicians who thought that way. And I wanted to learn to think that way myself. So I enrolled to train. And that's kind of my pathway.
It's a wonderful story. It actually dovetails with an older story very briefly. After World War II, many psychiatrists who were exposed in working with what we now call PTSD, worked with analysts, and I have spoken with them years past, and they said almost exactly what you said, which is that they think differently. Mm-hmm. And I want to learn how they think. And that is one of the reasons it is said that many clinicians pursued analytic training after the war, that they were influenced by teachers and mentors who demonstrated an analytic mindset and people identified. That's different and that's valuable.
Absolutely. I agree.
So you discovered this was different and valuable, and you began training. And what was that like? That's sort of like going back to the beginning in some ways, yeah?
Yeah, I think I enjoy learning. So it didn't feel like a beginning. It felt like a supplement or an addition. It still feels, you know, I just finished seminars, actually. I'm just about to finish up all of my cases. And it feels like an extension of everything and a deepening, frankly. And I mean, there are moments when I recognize that my fellow candidates are younger than I am. And there are moments when I wish that I had started earlier. But in many ways, I think that the richness of all of the things that I've lived up to this point make my analytic training far more rich and interesting anyway. So it doesn't feel that way, actually.
Mm. Now, you do bring these two mindsets. You can think like a tech person and you can think like an analyst. And you can also think like an analyst understanding how a tech person thinks, which is probably fascinating, but also clinically useful because you treat numbers of people from the tech world. Mm-hmm. Share with us, give us the inside scoop for those of us who are not techie type people. Mm-hmm. And we sort of in a childlike way just see the world changing in these mysterious ways, and our world both being improved and being changed in not so good ways. But many of us experience this as it's happening to us. But you know the people who are making this happen. Tell us about the people who you work with, either as colleagues or as when they are your patients.
Mm-hmm. So I think I'd like to say a little bit about these two mindsets. There's one of the episodes of the podcast that I host is with a gentleman named Steven Luger, and he wrote about he wrote and spoke about on the podcast about cruel optimization. And I think that episode, for any listener who's interested, is a really good discussion of the differences in the mindsets that happen for people who are steeped in technology. And so I'll just summarize a little bit, borrowing from him. And I think it concurs with what I've noticed. So technology is based on the premise that there can be an optimization of things through algorithmic understandings. So ones and zeros, data can be manipulated and thus produce an optimal outcome, which is a lovely idea for certain kinds of things. It's not necessarily, in my opinion, the best idea for the psyche or for happiness or for, you know, developing a life that's worth meaning. So I think a psychological mindset is slightly different in that most of us, unless we've trained as, you know, CBT clinicians, and even then, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it's not just data points, you know, input, output, handbook-based treatment. There's the relationship, and that's difficult to categorize. So I think I think psychologically speaking, people are really concerned, or, you know, our colleagues are really concerned with being with the person, making meanings, suffering sometimes through difficult things. So there isn't just an automatic assumption, as there is in the tech mindset, that we're trying to optimize for whatever it is that's good. It becomes very philosophical in the end. You know, what is optimized? What is good? Why should we do it? You know, there's all these kinds of questions that one might ask the technology mindset person. You know, why would we want to hack our nutrition or our mental health in order to become stronger, better? What? It's a little problematic, I think, as an end goal. So the tech mindset comes out of the tech development of the times, where there's this incredible competition for the best idea, the unicorn idea that's going to strike it rich. It's kind of like a gold mindset, you know, gold strike it rich kind of mindset. Mm-hmm. There's tremendous optimism and hope. There's all kinds of resources and creativity. You know, some of the mantras that some of the tech folks have is fail fast so that you can get more data out of the failure and move forward, which is kind of a creative idea, but it's also barreling forward into whatever the next thing is with whoever has the biggest idea without consequence to what's happening right now emotionally, what's happening right now. Should we do that? Should we not do that? Maybe should we consider the outcomes, the unintended consequences, and so on. I would also say that a tech mindset also includes tremendous wealth and tremendous struggle. These are like hero stories where people can strike it rich and invent the next best thing that's going to save us all from, environmental, dread and so on. Mm-hmm. Or it's just incredible hubris. So we can't yet tell whether or not some of the things that are coming out of this mindset are truly useful. Many of them are, and many of them are really problematic. So I think that's the tech mindset in short. What I find is really interesting in working with patients who are in tech, and I won't say a lot about my patients, but I will say that being in the Bay Area and being someone who can kind of speak a little bit of tech, just enough to get myself in trouble, people feel comfortable speaking to me about vectors that they're dealing with as they're trying to program some sort of self-parking something downtown, you know, something along the lines of Tesla, but not Tesla. Or people feel comfortable talking about the nitty-gritty, the nerdy aspects of their work, which is really useful to have another mind who can help you think about the emotional aspects of the nerdy aspects of the tech. So I think there's something interesting when these kinds of things come together. Hmm. There's also the idea that tech folks sometimes, you know, the frame of psychoanalysis or of clinical work is different for them because they might have just acquired massive amounts of wealth. And so what to do with someone who doesn't have time to come to the office because they're in their private jet going wherever, or someone who has to meet with their investors and so on, there's some creative things that have to happen with the frame sometimes in order to make sure that the work can proceed.
For example?
Well, I've scheduled appointments at very odd times. I've met with patients remotely before COVID, because that was the only way to continue the work, and then to mm-hmm. continue in person again. I've had sessions that are different lengths at much more frequent intervals. So maybe a 15-minute session followed by an hour and a half session the next day in order to accommodate their meeting schedules. Because they want to continue the work and it's the only way, it seems.
There's so much conversation today about analysts and an analyst coming from different cultures and the challenges that that presents. The opportunities aren't as focused on as the challenges. So just to stay with that. And again, you say you know enough to get you in trouble, but nevertheless, you're describing, if I hear you right, people who think with X's and O's. Mm-hmm. And that is different. Just to take an extreme, not to valorize it, but reverie, letting one's mind go, free associating, mm-hmm. is a different skill set than deepening one's possibilities of various algorithms. What kind of challenge does that present to you?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first defensive moves that many of the tech clients might offer is something along the lines of, hey, how many sessions is this going to take?
Right,
and how long is it, you know, how long and why? What are you going to do? Uh-huh. And why are you different than someone else? How do I know that you're the best, the optimized version of treatment? Mm-hmm. I have people selling me ayahuasca. I have people selling me, you know, 10 session CBT. How do I know that you're the best? And so, you know, that may come across as narcissistic or, you know, grandiose or kind of an intense devaluing. And I think in order to meet them where they are and treat it like it is a different culture, which I think it is, that's mm-hmm. a really good metaphor. One has to sort of stand back and say, well, of course, that's the question you're asking. That's the question you're steeped in every single day. And you're also having an urgent sensation of time being of the essence. The next unicorn company is around the corner. Everything has to fail fast. You need to break me fast in order to decide how this is going to work too. Of course, you're applying that. And so I have to quickly lean in and I think meet that devaluing attack with something that gives them a taste of what it is to enjoy a riddle that is psychoanalysis. So something that gives them that mystery, something that gives them, spins them on their head, opens up something new that is outside of X's and O's and ones and zeros and so on, and causes them to think. And I think this is the biggest issue, is that we've lost our ability to think creatively and we've lost our ability to be in negative capability and to take up things that are outside of our usual wheelhouse. And so I think offering them an opportunity for that is the first necessary step. From there, they usually, like any other patient, develop a relationship, and so the treatment goes.
The temptation is to have them borrow our worldview and to develop the skills that we think would be good for them to have. Mm-hmm. But speaking of narcissism, that would spare us the important task of learning something from them. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of what we can learn from them?
I think we can learn a lot from them. And at the same time, I also think that we have a lot to give them. So the first, you know, the obvious things that we could learn from them, what we've learned during COVID and all of the remote work that we've done, is that I don't think we have a solid grasp, or as solid as I would like, or as many of our colleagues would like, on privacy. I've heard stories of, I'm doing an IPA research grant study on teleanalysis right now during COVID. So I've interviewed analysts and candidate analysis and training analyses about their experiences. And what I've heard in those narratives is that people are doing a wide variety of things with the frame and a wide variety of things with which platforms they're using. What I'm concerned about is that some of my tech patients are really not satisfied with the security of Zoom or Doxy or FaceTime. And that seems to be what most of us are using. And many of them have some insider knowledge about end-to-end encryption and what kinds of things can happen inside of these tools because they work in those companies. Mm-hmm. And so the hairs on the back of my neck kind of go up and in realizing, I don't know if we as a group know enough or have a position yet on what the tools of our trade in remote work do and what they don't do. So I think that's the first thing we could learn from them, is really buttoning that up. The second thing I think we could learn from them is a little bit of efficiency and creativity and innovation, you know, that kind of starry-eyed, young, hopeful kind of feeling. In some ways, many of us have lost that. My sense of a a psychoanalytic task force or, you know, meeting might include us associating, and it might feel a little bit like a Quaker meeting, or there might be some emotional charge. But sometimes we don't get busy doing things, and sometimes it might be helpful if we did. This is not to say that I think we should not attend to group process or that we should not be in the unknown, et cetera. That's extremely valuable. But I think we could learn a little bit about efficiency and being willing to take risks, being willing to innovate from this group. Yeah, and maybe we could learn a little bit about hope. Many of them are hopeful, very hopeful about the future, and might have some answers. And I wonder if psychoanalysis needs some hope and needs some innovation.
Do you find that the patients, for a variety of reasons, are eager to help you if they see you doing something that they deem old-fashioned?
Yes.
Do they want to nudge you along in the direction of, oh, be more modern, you know, be up to date?
Absolutely. I mean, many of them would like to, and probably other analysts have had this experience, many of them would like to text, or they'd like to utilize different modes of communication. And sometimes we go back and forth on why I don't do that and what that means. But I had one patient tell me, and he's in the security and privacy sector, one patient tell me that I should use Signal. And this was kind of and he insisted, in fact, he said, I'm not going to continue with the treatment if you don't, for our remote sessions. And I complied. I had to download this, you know, this app that I didn't understand and use it because it's not end-to-end encrypted and it doesn't live on anyone's servers. And it occurred to me that he was basically giving me a lesson in, you're antiquated and you think you're HIPAA compliant and you think you have all these things, but you've ignored the most basic risks to security. And those are people inside the companies that your Doxy and Zoom and so on have access to your data. And if there's a nefarious person, I don't want my data compromised. So, you know, one could argue that that's paranoid or that that's problematic. But at the same time, I don't really want to risk having anything go awry with any of my patients' data. So it was a good lesson.
Was it a prelude to him revealing something that he thought was particularly private?
I would say that in every session, people are revealing things that are particularly private,
But
it wasn't it didn't strike me as... It was the prelude to our very first remote session, our very first online session.
You've mentioned here in their cases. Can you present so that the listener will get a feel, a composite, not an actual person, of someone who comes to your office with the backgrounds that we're describing and the kinds of challenges and the different languages that you two struggled with?
I think there's two kinds of cases. There's the case of the hero and the case of the... you know, the person who has failed. There are many engineers and, you know, tech developers who have not yet struck it rich, who are deeply depressed because they believe that they should have already achieved something. And they're kind of trapped in the San Francisco Bay Area where it's very difficult to buy a house. It's very expensive. They feel like they should have made it. They're not able to make the right turn and get into the right company, or their personalities are such that they're not able to work constructively with others, and they haven't yet quite made it. And so they're kind of stuck in an apartment, hoping and dreaming and reaching their 30s, and maybe, you know, delaying having a family and really struggling with meaning and purpose. That's kind of one group. And then there's another group that comes, and sometimes that comes with a bunch of other things, porn addictions, sex addictions, drug addictions, you know, these kinds of things, or problematic behaviors, problematic personality stuff. There's another group that has already made it and they're quasi-retired at 30-something or 40-something. Mm. And they can, you know, go to dinner in Spain for the day if they want, and they have access to tremendous wealth, and they're not happy, and they're looking for meaning. And that group is a really interesting group because it's, I don't think that's been so frequent prior to this decade. But we do see that in the San Francisco Bay Area, where there are smatterings of people who are exquisitely rich and have nothing to do. They've done it all, or they feel like they've done it all. And so the next frontier is to go inward. And those are really interesting cases. Hmm.
People talk about the dangers facing us. It's usually in reference to AI, artificial intelligence, but it's not limited to that. Is this something that you either know about, hear about, have your own concerns about?
I would say all of the above. I started the podcast because I am deeply concerned. And, you know, part of the pivot away from tech was really an ethical dilemma that I think is embedded within our engagement with tech. And the biggest dilemma is that we don't have, I believe, as a group, all of us, all tech users, don't have enough space from the click and the feedback loop that we get to not be seduced and to think for ourselves. So there's this sense of we're kind of going along like lemmings, I believe, collectively. I include myself in that. Not knowing enough about what's going on the back end and not being able to predict easily how it's going to foreclose our attention or how it's going to affect our capacities for negative capability or creativity or relatedness. And I think that's really dangerous. So while everyone's focusing on AI and truth and privacy and so on, and I think we should be focused on that, that's largely, you know, super general AI and all of the regulatory things that go on with that. That is largely a fantasy right now. The real thing that's going on is the everyday use of a cell phone. And the everyday use of a cell phone, as far as I can tell, is taking up more of our time, is taking away our eye gaze toward the world and other people some of the time, and is foreclosing our ability to think. And I worry about young people in particular who are raised with cell phones, who are raised, you know, these are useful tools, but they're highly addictive and very problematic. And kids can't easily discern the difference between TikTok and news. They're even more susceptible to different kinds of problems than we are as adults. And the adults aren't doing much better, frankly. So I think those are the concerns that I largely harbor is how do we preserve what we offer our patients in an analytic hour, freedom, free association, reverie, and so on. How do we preserve that in a world that is constantly bombarding us with attention-seeking things that are very captivating and compelling?
Now, there's a question. And you hear it a great deal with people with young kids about how they negotiated it. It used to be, you know, you put them in front of the TV and you felt guilty about it, but it gave you some breathing time. Mm-hmm. Now it's put them in front of a screen and the same dilemma, but it has obviously more opportunities. You can control the TV a lot easier than you can the screen.
Well, also the TV is a social phenomenon. So the TV is on in the living room ostensibly. And I was one of the mm-hmm. kids who, you know, your mother called it the boob tube and said, get away from the boob tube. You're losing brain cells. Parents were looking over the shoulders of us while we were watching TV and knew what we were watching. And in my day, there were only three channels. Right. So, you know, you're watching one of three things. It's pretty, other families are watching it. And eventually you got bored because something would come on that was boring and you would turn it off and you would move on. Kids these days, they can go everywhere. First of all, many kids try to find when they're bored, they try to find the end of the internet. And you can end up in some pretty intense places. So they end up sensationally seeking more stimulus when they get bored. We couldn't do that with TVs. And also parents aren't looking over the shoulder and noticing everything that kids are watching and commenting on it. Hey, you probably shouldn't think about that. That's a little scary. Let me give you some history of what really happened about that to buffer you because you've got, you know, fake news going on. That you're listening to. Are you aware of that? That's not happening. So we've lost touch with what our kids are taking in. Hmm. We also aren't having a social conversation. So think about this. When we get into a car now, if you get into a car with teenagers or with other people, sometimes people will have earbuds in and everybody's on their own program. What becomes of the conversation compared to putting something on the radio and talking about it together?
Dramatic change. Life is different entirely. Yes. So using that as a stepping stone, let me ask you to do what's difficult to do. It's like picking who's going to win the NBA finals. Give us a glimpse into the future. What would you guess we would be talking about in 5-10 years?
I think it will get worse before it gets better. But I think that there are some really innovative things that might come out of technology that might help us with the environment, that might help us with racism, that might help us with social problems and so on. I think we may have to suffer also some real big issues, things on the order of political echo chambers that drive elections in more problematic ways than we've already seen, or slip ups with privacy and so on that really create conflicts and problems for people. But I have some faith in, there's some new trends. Some youth are turning toward flip phones because they're bothered by the constant mm-hmm. onslaught. There's more talk about regulatory control. I think the CEO of OpenAI, Sam Altman, just went and testified about the need for regulatory control of AI. There's some things that are happening that I think are good. In the end, we are not a collective, suicidal group. I'm sure the pendulum will swing and people will start to innovate. So I have some hope for that. But I do think we'll go through some pain first, in part because there's a lot of money to be made in tech right now, more than the waves of stuff that I saw. So Google made a lot of money as they grew and, had their advertising and so on as their main engine. Amazon's made a lot of money. Cell phones have made a lot of money. I think the thing that is, AI is going to drive a whole lot of income for a whole lot of people, and it's going to create separations in wealth that are pretty significant. And if that happens, we're going to see, wars and tumult and conflict and difficulties and so on, as we always have seen when those kinds of things happen. So I imagine that it'll be a mixed bag. For us as a field, I don't think we're going to be taken over by a Freud bot. I think we have something really unique to offer, a space where people are not bombarded with these things and can be free. And I think that's going to be really good for our profession. I think we're going to be sought out more and more.
Nicole, you have called for analysts to be involved in these upcoming decisions as ethicists, as clinicians, as people of the mind. Is that a fair characterization of your thinking?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think Sherry Turkle and Todd Essig and a bunch of others, in the United States have certainly voiced many opinions before me about the role of psychoanalysis and analytic thinking in thinking about technology. And I would like to build on what they've started and make sure that the conversation continues and make sure that we preserve a space for us all to think.
Hmm. Well, you're my first nominee to be on the ethics board of the psychoanalytic technology interface. It's a pleasure to hear you think so deeply and have this rich experience in both worlds and be able to speak cross languages. They say when kids learn two languages early on, there's a facility in their mind that lasts forever. And that seems to apply to you. I mean, you really can go back and forth and appreciate each other's mindsets. And your patients are lucky, and we as a field are lucky, because we can listen in on that mind of yours on your podcast, Technology in the Mind. I want to thank you for being on this one and for opening us up in a new direction, something that many of us wonder about, feel a little overwhelmed by, but I at least feel somewhat reassured that there are people like yourself who are doing the hard work and watching out for us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Very kind of you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.